Go.
Hey everybody, welcome to Project 4-4, the February 24th edition. Today you read in the book of Leviticus chapter 21, 22, 23, and 25. And we're going to be discussing a couple of more subjects around religious and ceremonial law. Two things that we're going to be taking a look at: the rules for the priest, the sabbatical year, and the year of Jubilee. And be sure you hang on to the end of this accelerator because the stuff around the year of Jubilee is very exciting. Well, first we hit the rules for the priest. And the truth is that these rules related to cleanness were primarily designed to teach us something about holiness. Here's some principles that guide this entire section. Number one, God is holy. Number two, because God is holy, the worship of a holy God demands moral and physical purity. And then number three, God's holiness sets the standards of perfection. The emphasis on physical cleanliness and physical perfection is only meant to mirror the more important issues of moral purity and spiritual perfection. So here's a few rules for the priest that are worth highlighting. We began by reading regulations pertaining to the priests. The emphasis here, and as we've come to expect, is upon the fact that a priest must remain clean before the Lord. And the reason, which is given over and over again, is this: because I, the Lord your God, am a holy God. I'm the one who made you holy. Three different times in chapter 21 that's stated, and several more times it simply says, I am the Lord. And that's enough to remind the readers of their need for holiness. I'm God, and so I'm holy, you should be holy. A priest, we're told in chapter 21, must not make himself ceremonially unclean for anyone who dies, even for a close relative, a mother, a father, a brother, or an unmarried dependent sister, must not make himself ceremonially unclean except for somebody who is very close to them. So if you're a priest who wants to stay clean, you can't touch any dead bodies. The high priest couldn't even defile himself by touching those who were close to himself, even the dead body of his mother or his father. Now, knowing this truth can shed some light on the familiar story in the New Testament called the Good Samaritan. You remember that story, of course. And most of us have some pretty bad feelings towards the priest and the Levite who passed by on the other side of the road. But there was really more at issue in the minds of those with the trouble that's involved, or the time that it might take, or the danger inherent in ministering to the mugging victim found on the road. They were probably also thinking this way: if the man who is badly injured is dead, or if he dies while I'm tending to him, then I will also be ceremonially unclean. Or if after I touch him I discover that he's leprous or he has sores or other conditions that would render me unclean, I would have violated the law. Even if I want to help him, I dare not take the risk. Their goal was moral purity. Now, they may not have made the right decision, but understanding this helps us to see a little bit more of their thought pattern in crossing over to the other side of the road so they wouldn't be impure before God. Now, you'll notice with this and so many other of the rituals to remain ceremonially clean, there's also a very high pragmatic value. As you read today, I'm sure that you thought, you know, these people were not equipped with modern-day germ theory, but the things that they were doing would prevent them from experiencing pain and damage and disease through germs. For example, you can't eat meat that's been sacrificed on the third day. You can the first day or the second day. Well, today we know that eating meat that's unrefrigerated for a couple of days creates some danger inherent in eating that. Or you can't touch a dead body and then eat. Or you're not allowed to eat animals that you found dead or were torn by wild animals. All these not only had a spiritual value, they also had a highly pragmatic value. And following these laws that you find throughout Leviticus and Numbers actually helped the Israelites not only to be morally and spiritually pure, but also to stay healthy as a people group. Well, after you get past the cleanliness of the priest, you have the sabbatical year and the Jubilee. Now, to comment on Leviticus 25, I found a great summary on the sabbatical year and the year of Jubilee taken from the Archaeological Study Bible, page 189. It says this: the principle of the Sabbath day was extended to legislation of a sabbatical year every 7 years and a Jubilee year every 50 years. That is 7 times 7 plus 1. The verse 4 stipulated that every seventh year the Israelites were to give the land a Sabbath for rest, to allow anyone, including slaves and sojourners, temporary residents, to gather the produce that had grown that year. Then every 50th year, following the seven Sabbaths of seven each, those who had acquired others' ancestral lands were obligated to return them to their original owners, verses 8 through 10. Israelite slaves were also to be released and allowed to return to their families, verses 39 through 41. And it would be a day of rejoicing for all of the people. Now for me, as an economics major, this is an absolute stroke of genius. If you think that at the end of every 50 years, slaves had to be freed and everybody got the land of their fathers. In most economies around the world, economic abuses happen in a division between the haves and the have-nots. Those people who are able to acquire land and acquire slaves become wealthier and wealthier and wealthier and become the oppressors of the masses. Those people who lose their land or become slaves actually are the victims that are oppressed forever. But the Jubilee year gives a mechanism by which economically a culture can remain strong for generations to come, and that every single person will have at least one once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be free, to have land, and to make a life for themselves. So whenever you would sell land, it would only be for an amount of time until the Jubilee year. Whenever you would buy a slave, it wasn't forever, it was only until the Jubilee year hit. Now think about this. Jubilee is debts forgiven and slaves set free. Debts forgiven, slaves set free. What does that remind you of? How about Jesus' work on the cross? As a matter of fact, you may want to write this down on your Jesus sightings page in your journal. You see, Jubilee is not just economic genius, not just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to start over. It's actually a picture of Jesus and a picture of the good news that he brings to us. You see, at the cross, people get a shot at starting all over again, where their sins are forgiven, their debts are forgiven, and they're set free with a fresh start and a new beginning. This is really, really good news. And once again, God is setting up the people of Israel to hear that good news in Jesus. Well, this has been Mark Ashton reminding you today that Jesus is our Jubilee.